Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and every week I read from their website, which is ew.com. This week I'm starting with the must list. I have a few Oscar articles because those just finished up, and then some articles that I kept from last week, a couple reviews of TV shows. So first up, this must list, Deli Boys, a Kelsey Ballerini deluxe release, and Queen of the Ring top this week's must list. A new BritBox dark comedy from Stephen Moffat and Susanna Kearsley's latest historical fiction novel round out our picks. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. With awards season officially over, at least for a week or two before Emmy's chatter revs up, I'm officially in catch-up mode, finishing What If, and finally starting Yellowjackets Season 3. But the increased TV bandwidth also comes at the best time for reality competition, with the launch of my perennial faves, Survivor and Amazing Race, and the conclusions of Traitors and Deal or No Deal Island. Seriously, give Deal or No Deal Island a shot. Joe Manganiello is becoming one of my favorite reality hosts. That's Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. So the first item on our must list is Deli Boys. After the death of their convenience store magnate father, two pampered Pakistani-American brothers, played by Asif Ali and Segar Shaki, must reckon with his secret life of crime in this wildly entertaining new comedy series on Hulu. Their father, it turns out, has been using the chain of delis as a front for his cocaine empire, leaving the shell-shocked boys as heirs of his drug empire. Bonus, Tan France, best known as the style expert on Queer Eye, cameos as a murderous drug lord from a rival distributor. Patterns, Deluxe by Kelsey Ballerini. Kelsey Ballerini has more baggage to unpack. 4 months after first releasing Patterns, the singer-songwriter adds 5 new songs, including previously unreleased fan favorite To the Men That Love Women After Heartbreak, a sentimental ballad that encapsulates healing after love lost. Queen of the Ring. Emily Bette Ricards, from Arrow and The Flash, transforms into revolutionary wrestler Mildred Burke in a film directed by Ash Avildsen that showcases Burke's history-making odyssey to carve out a place for women within a sport that wasn't interested in changing. Douglas is canceled. News anchor Douglas Bellows, played by Hugh Bonneville, stumbles into a career-threatening scandal when he's accused of making a sexist joke at a wedding. Stephen Moffat's dark comedy, which can be streamed on BritBox, explores the naughty nuances of gender politics and features a breathtaking performance from Karen Gillan as Douglas's co-host. Our book this week is The King's Messenger. Author Susanna Kearsley's knack for historical intrigue and detailed research shines in this tale of Jacoby Britton. Andrew is a messenger and secretly a gifted seer for King James I. When sent to arrest Sir David Moray, he and his traveling companions uncover a betrayal that throws them into a tempest of treachery and romance. That is the must list for this week, and it was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. There's the big story on the website. I'm leading with that here. It's Gene Hackman and wife Betsy Arakawa's separate causes of death revealed by medical examiners. The Oscar-winning actor and the classical pianist likely died several days apart. This is by Wesley Stenzel. Authorities have announced the causes of death for Oscar-winning actor Gene Hackman and his wife, classical pianist Betsy Arakawa. Hackman, 95, died from heart disease, with Alzheimer's disease as a significant contributory factor, according to Dr. Heather Jarrell, New Mexico's chief medical investigator, who spoke in a press conference. The specific cause was hypertensive and atherosclerotic cardiac disease. Jarrell noted that it was difficult to say whether Hackman had experienced a recent heart attack, but found evidence of prior heart attacks and severe heart disease. The last event recorded on Hackman's pacemaker occurred February 17. Medical examiners determined that Arakawa's death at 65 was caused by hantavirus pulmonary syndrome, a disease usually contracted from exposure to mouse droppings that affects the lungs. The manner of death was ruled as natural, with no findings of trauma internally or externally. Examiners also estimated that Arakawa died around February 11th, which means Hackman almost certainly died several days after his wife. Santa Fe County Sheriff Adam Mendoza said that Arakawa was last seen running errands in public on February 11th, and that authorities had not found any correspondence from either Hackman or Arakawa after that day. The results of the necropsy for the couple's dog, Xena, are still pending. Hackman and Arakawa were found dead in their home alongside one of their three dogs on February 26th. Hackman's body was found in the mudroom next to a pair of sunglasses and a walking cane, and the investigating officer suspected that the actor had suddenly fallen, per an affidavit obtained by Entertainment Weekly. That was Gene Hackman and wife Betsy Arakawa's separate causes of death revealed by medical examiners, and it was by Wesley Stenzel. On a happier note, let's take a look now at the 15 best Gene Hackman movies ranked from his acclaimed turn in The Conversation to a side-splitting cameo in Young Frankenstein. Entertainment Weekly honors the late actor by looking back on his most beloved performances. This is by Randall Colburn. Oscar-winning actor and Hollywood legend Gene Hackman was found dead in his Santa Fe, New Mexico home at age 95. An everyman's movie star, Hackman bounced between comedy, drama, action, and suspense, working with lauded filmmakers like William Friedkin, Francis Ford Coppola, Mel Brooks, Warren Beatty, Wes Anderson, and many more. He won two Academy Awards for The French Connection and Unforgiven, and was nominated three more times for his turns in Mississippi Burning, I Never Sang for My Father, and Bonnie and Clyde. He was also cinema's first depiction of Superman Big Bad Lex Luthor. Beginning with Bonnie and Clyde, Hackman kicked off a brilliant run of films that would put any actor not named Nicholson, Redford, or Pacino to shame, Entertainment Weekly declared in 2006 in a piece asking if Hackman was indeed the greatest actor ever. His sharp tongue, keen comic timing, and amiable spirit elevated every role he tackled. That makes choosing 15 of the best especially tough, but we did our best. Here are Entertainment Weekly's picks for Gene Hackman's best movie roles ranked. There are 15 here, and number 15 is Reds from 1981. For years, Hackman thought he disappointed Beatty with his performance as magazine editor Pete Van Wery in the director's Reds, a three-hour epic about the American communist movement. After repeated takes on one scene, how many I lost count, Beatty calmly moved on, saying, print numbers 7 and 12. The fact that I hadn't solved the character well enough to get it even close was never brought up, Hackman said. But after Entertainment Weekly's writer read that quote to Beatty in 2016, the actor and director began to tear up. Gene said that? He's wrong. He got it, Beatty retorted. He had a temperature of 102, and he flew all the way over to London to do this one scene where he just talks his ass off. He said, I'm not getting this. And I said, no, you are. With Hackman, you just do more takes because who knows? Let's see what might happen here. But I knew I had it. I've never worked with a better actor. We can watch Reds on Pluto TV. Hoosiers from 1986 is number 14. Hoosiers doesn't have the jagged edges of The French Connection or the gee golly whimsy of the Royal Tenenbaums. But David Anspaugh's 1986 drama is a must-watch for anyone with a soft spot for small-town sports. Hackman plays Norman Dale, the new coach of an Indiana high school basketball team with the chutzpah to take them to the state finals. It's a low-stakes film that feels much bigger, which is due in no small part to Hackman's deceptively straightforward performance, which reveals more and more layers as the story unfolds. We can watch Hoosiers on Amazon Prime Video to rent. No Way Out is from 1987. In 1987, Hackman starred opposite Kevin Costner and Sean Young in Roger Donaldson's No Way Out, which finds his desperate government bigwig, David Bryce, with blood on his hands after an accidental murder of his mistress. It's a vicious and two-faced performance that sees the actor sweatily posturing to great effect as the walls close in. In their review, the New York Times declared Hackman to be leaner, sharper, and better than he's been in years. We can watch No Way Out on Tubi. Young Frankenstein from 1974. One of the best unbilled movie performances of all time is Hackman's surprising and hilarious appearance in Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein. With long gray hair and a Nostradamus beard, the actor is nearly unrecognizable as a bumbling blind weirdo who treats Peter Boyle's escaped monster to some hot soup. Hackman did his fair share of comedy, but he was rarely able to get this silly. These days, the short scene is one of the most widely remembered moments and routinely garners some of the movie's biggest laughs, thanks to a combination of Hackman's brilliant comic timing and Brooks's memorable dialogue, Entertainment Weekly's writer remarked. We can watch Young Frankenstein. Oh, we can't. It's not available to stream. So find a friend who has it on DVD, because it is available to purchase. Mississippi Burning from 1988 is number 11. Mississippi Burning, Alan Parker's 1988 film about FBI agents investigating the disappearance of civil rights workers in Mississippi, certainly has its critics. Entertainment Weekly called the film infuriating and fraudulent in 1991. No matter your thoughts on the film itself, though, it's hard to deny the power and subtlety of Hackman's Oscar-nominated performance as Rupert Anderson, an FBI agent and former Mississippi sheriff unafraid to deviate from protocol. The New York Times described Hackman's Anderson as the movie's remarkable dramatic core, calling his performance achingly plausible and persuasive. We can watch Mississippi Burning on Tubi. Crimson Tide is from 1995. There are many reasons to watch Crimson Tide. Tony Scott's staging and craft, amusing dialogue from an uncredited Quentin Tarantino. But it's the immense pleasure of watching Hackman and Denzel Washington face off in a duel of wits and wills, in a submarine no less, that cements the film as a classic. The two actors turn the film into a riveting Oedipal military duel, Entertainment Weekly's critic wrote in their review, with our critic specifically shouting out Hackman's cigar-chomping Captain Ramsay. By now, Hackman practically teases us with the ease of his arrogance. Ramsay's power lies in the wrath behind his paternal charm, the way he goads people into challenging his authority. And Washington makes us register Hunter's wary moral intelligence as a kind of physical force. The end of the world may be around the corner, but what holds us is the sight of two superlatively fierce actors working at the top of their game. We can watch Crimson Tide on Amazon Prime Video to rent. The Birdcage is number 9, and it's from 1996. Hackman told The Advocate he took the role of hyper-conservative Senator Kevin Keeley in Mike Nichols' The Birdcage because he relished the chance to return to his roots in improvisational comedy. And there was ample opportunity for it in this uproarious farce, which finds Keeley meeting the gay parents, played by Robin Williams and Nathan Lane, of the man who's set to marry his daughter. But it wasn't just about the laughs. I had to get inside of Keeley's rigid self-protection to understand the driving force of prejudice, he told The Advocate. The role would be one-dimensional in lesser hands, but Hackman's performance is both affecting and hilarious. In his review, beloved critic Roger Ebert declared that in a film full of very funny people, Hackman was responsible for the biggest laughs. That's impressive for an actor who'd recently come off the decidedly unhilarious Forgiven. We can watch The Birdcage on Max. Bonnie and Clyde is from 1967. Hackman was 37 when he enjoyed his breakout role in Arthur Penn's rule-breaking Bonnie and Clyde. But as Entertainment Weekly's critic put it, he already gave off the mothball and hard candy scent of someone who'd been used up and spat out. That's a compliment, by the way. Hackman played the hothead Buck Barrow, brother to Beatty's Clyde in the 1967 outlaw romance. Hackman and co-star Estelle Parsons, per Entertainment Weekly's critic, deliver unguarded, go-for-broke performances that charge a movie designed to explode like a bomb in the audience's face. It would score the actor his first Academy Award nomination. We can watch Bonnie and Clyde on Amazon Prime Video to rent. Unforgiven is number 7, that's from 1992. Hackman won his second Oscar for Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven, a pitch-black western about an outlaw-turned-farmer whose return to gunslinging puts him in the sights of Hackman's sheriff, Little Bill Daggett. In Entertainment Weekly's original review, our critic called Little Bill a muddled enigma. In another article, two Entertainment Weekly writers disagreed about the character, with one deeming him a psycho, and the other admitting he almost sympathizes with Little's brand of law. All these years later, that performance's moral ambiguity is a feature, not a bug, and there's a thrill to watching Hackman deftly navigate the character's warring impulses. Morgan Freeman, who starred in the film alongside Hackman, shared a tribute to his former co-star at the Oscars. One of the personal highlights of my career was bringing the French film Garde à Vue, Under Suspicion, to life with the incredibly gifted Gene Hackman. And of course, Unforgiven. Rest in peace, my friend. We can watch Unforgiven on Amazon Prime Video. Scarecrow is from 1973. Hackman starred opposite Al Pacino in the cult film Scarecrow, Jerry Schatzberg's road movie about a pair of hitchhikers that develop an unlikely friendship. Hackman's sad sack turn as the ex-con drifter Max is, hands down, one of the great lost performances of the 70s. And, in my opinion, his second richest character next to The Conversation's Harry Call, Entertainment Weekly's critic wrote in 2006. Not to mention the fact that he steals the movie from co-star Al Pacino, a feat that would seem almost mathematically impossible. The film's most memorable moment? A scene where Hackman gets hammered and eats chicken. It's the only convincing portrayal of being wasted I've ever seen, said our critic, saying that the little scene convinced them that Gene Hackman may be the finest actor alive. We can watch Scarecrow on Hulu. Night Moves is number 5, and it's from 1975. Hackman and Bonnie and Clyde director Arthur Penn reteamed in 1975 for Night Moves, an excellent neo-noir that was nevertheless a box office dud. As such, Hackman's turn as a private investigator befuddled by the disappearance of a former movie star's daughter was, for many years, almost forgotten, despite the actor scoring a BAFTA nomination for the performance. In the years since, though, many have sought to shine a spotlight back on the film. In 2001, Entertainment Weekly named it one of the best classic movies to go unrecognized. Even more than Roman Polanski's Chinatown, Night Moves finds everything and everyone to be riddled with guilt. Even the hero is reduced to peeping on his own errant wife, our critic wrote. We can watch Night Moves on Hulu. Superman, from 1978, is number four. Superman baddie Lex Luthor has been played by many, many actors, including Kevin Spacey in Superman Returns, Jesse Eisenberg in Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice, and Michael Rosenbaum from Smallville. None of them, however, were able to capture the devious glee that defined Hackman's smarmy turns in Richard Donner's Superman from 1978 and Richard Lester's Superman II in 1980, which Entertainment Weekly previously lauded for their winky sense of wickedness. Today's purveyor of superhero flicks would be wise to revisit his performance, as it demonstrates what so many of them seem to have forgotten. These movies are supposed to be fun. Valerie Perrin, who played Eve, the girlfriend to Hackman's Lex, took to X to mourn her former co-star. The great Gene Hackman has passed away. He was a genius and one of the greatest to grace the silver screen. I had the honor of working with him on Superman. His performances are legendary. His talent will be missed. Goodbye, my sweet Lex, till we meet again. We can watch Superman on Max. Number three from 1971 is The French Connection. Hackman scored his first Oscar for playing The French Connection's Popeye Doyle, a character that remains one of the most scorching and enduring depictions of what's now a fairly standard archetype, the bad cop with nothing to lose. Countless films have tried to emulate its greatness since, but The French Connection is the modern blueprint of the genre for a reason, Entertainment Weekly's writer declared. Gene Hackman, who developed new shades of menace and gravitas with each passing year, turns in a career-best performance as the determined and obsessive Detective Jimmy Popeye Doyle, who, along with Roy Scheider as his partner, seems truly willing to lose his life if it means catching Fernando Rey's Alain, Frog One, Charnier. Also, did you know that the Popeye's Chicken franchise was named after his character? We didn't either. We can watch The French Connection on Amazon Prime Video to rent. The Royal Tenenbaums from 2001 is number two. Gene Hackman didn't want to play Royal Tenenbaum. It took a while for Anderson, who wrote the role for Hackman against his wishes, to get Hackman to sign on. And we're happy he did. As the boorish patriarch in a family of geniuses, Hackman is simultaneously crude and effervescent, hitting the script's notes of melancholy as well as he does its rude pseudo-insults, like when he calls Danny Glover's Henry Sherman Coltrane. The soul of the movie's eccentric generosity of spirit beats in Hackman's great, wise, subversively unsentimental performance as Royal, a grandfather who teaches his overdisciplined grandsons how to bet at dogfights and cross streets against the light, Entertainment Weekly's critic wrote in their review. We can watch The Royal Tenenbaums on Amazon Prime Video to rent. And the number one ranked movie, The Conversation from 1974. The Conversation is more than one of Entertainment Weekly's favorite mind-blowing conspiracy flicks. It's also one of the most prescient films ever made, a paranoid spiral into corporate surveillance born from the detritus of Watergate, Vietnam, and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Coppola's story of a surveillance expert whose work begins to impact his mind and morality is thrilling and affecting, but it's Hackman's twitchy, conflicted Harry Call that burns into the brain, his madness reflecting that of anyone who knows their work to be corrosive to America's soul. In his original review of the film, Ebert called Harry one of the most affecting and tragic characters in the movies. and when revisiting the film 25 years later, he called the role one of Hackman's key performances in a great career. Work going so far as to call it his best. Coppola paid tribute to Hackman following his death, writing, "The loss of a great artist always cause for both mourning and celebration." Gene Hackman, a great actor, inspiring and magnificent in his work and complexity, he wrote on Instagram, "I mourn his loss and celebrate his existence and contribution." We can watch the conversation on Amazon Prime Video to rent. Those are the 15 best Gene Hackman movies ranked, from his acclaimed turn in The Conversation to a side-splitting cameo in Young Frankenstein. It was by Randall Colburn. And this is already time to say that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly magazine, and I am reading from their website, which is EW.com. Somebody else who passed away recently was Dolly Parton's husband, and Dolly Parton dedicated a moving new song to her late husband. "He will always be the star of my life story." Carl Dean, Parton's husband of 60 years, died on March 3rd. This is by Rachel Schofield. Dolly Parton, who's put her life into beautiful songs through her whole career, from "I Will Always Love You" to "Jolene," just released the track "If You Hadn't Been There" in honor of husband Carl Dean's death on March 3rd. "I fell in love with Carl Dean when I was 18 years old. We have spent 60 precious and meaningful years together," the 10-time Grammy winner captioned a throwback image of the two together. "Like all great love stories, they never end. They live on in memory and song. He will always be the star of my life story, and I dedicate this song to him." Parton's lyrics were particularly touching. "I wouldn't be here if you hadn't been there, holding my hand, showing you care," she sings in the chorus. "You made me dream more than I dared, and I wouldn't be here if you hadn't been there." In the verses, the artist, actress, and philanthropist calls Dean her rock, wings, and confidence. She credited him with pushing me on when I was scared. Parton met Dean in 1964, well before she was the superstar she is today. The story goes that they first locked eyes on her first day in Nashville, Tennessee, the city where she had moved to pursue a career in music, in front of the wishy-washy laundromat. They married just 2 years later with only her late mother, Avie Lee Parton, and the preacher and his wife by their sides. She made her first big career move in 1967 when she joined the Porter Wagoner Show, the hard launch for her now legendary career. While Dean stayed out of the spotlight by choice, Parton referred to him regularly and even talked about other songs that he had inspired. She was open about the acclaimed song "Jolene," having been written after an attractive bank teller flirted with her man. "I love the old guy," Parton told E.T. in an interview upon a special release of the 9-to-5 DVD in 2006. "He's the only one I ever wanted, and the only one I'll ever have, I'm sure." She also called him her best friend. When he died, her team announced the sad news on social media. Their post included a quote from Parton, "Carl and I spent many wonderful years together. Words can't do justice to the love we shared for over 60 years." The songwriter had to try. That was Dolly Parton dedicates moving new song to her late husband, "He Will Always Be the Star of My Life Story." It was by Rachel Schufelt. They don't link to the song in the article, but I suspect if you were to search for it on the internet, you can probably find it on YouTube. The Oscars awards have all been handed out, and here is Entertainment Weekly's The Best and Worst Moments from the 2025 Oscars. We're still not over that opening number. This is by Samantha Heifel. "There's no other night in Hollywood quite like the Oscars. The red carpet looks, the acceptance speeches, the unexpected reunions. Okay, to be fair, there are plenty of nights like that in what Schitt's Creek's Moira Rose, played by Catherine O'Hara, once deemed her favorite season. Awards. But the Oscars always bring a little something extra special to close out the season, and this year was no different. We've rounded up the very best and worst moments from the 2025 broadcast hosted by Conan O'Brien. There are 8 of them here, and number 1, it's a best, Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande defy gravity. It's almost as if the Wizard of Oz had granted us our heart's desire with that opening number. If Ariana Grande singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow in a ruby red slipper dress wasn't enough, Cynthia Erivo then took the stage to perform Home. But because things could only get better, the Wicked co-stars then joined hands to sing the best part of Defying Gravity, the end of the song, when Glinda steps to the side as Elphaba takes to the sky and delivers the greatest riff of all time. Now that's how you open the Oscars. Another best is Adam Sandler. Adam Sandler will always be known first and foremost for his comedic skills. But let's be honest, his wardrobe isn't far behind. Sandler combined both of those things for a bit during host Conan O'Brien's opening monologue when he showed up in the crowd wearing basketball shorts and a hoodie. "You're dressed like a guy playing video poker at 2 a.m., O'Brien cracked. Sandler was so offended he stormed out of the Dolby Theater, but not before inviting everybody to join him for a game of 5-on-5 basketball and giving Timothy a quick Chalamet. Another best, Kieran Culkin reveals he wants 4 kids. Kieran Culkin may have won more than an Oscar. The A Real Pain star took home the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, and while accepting the award, he had a very specific story he wanted to tell involving his wife, Jazz Charlton. "About a year ago, I was on stage like this, and I very stupidly publicly said I wanted a 3rd kid from her because she said if I won the award, she would give me the kid," Culkin said. "Turns out she said that because she didn't think I was going to win. But apparently after that awards show, which was where he won an Emmy for lead actor in a drama series, Culkin revealed to his wife that he really wanted 4 kids, to which his wife said, I will give you 4 when you win an Oscar. So, as he reminded her, love of my life, ye of little faith, no pressure, I love you, I'm really sorry I did this again, and let's get cracking on those kids. What do you say? A worst is that confusing Bond tribute. Listen, we all love James Bond, and we can absolutely get behind a James Bond tribute, particularly given the recent news that the Broccoli family has given creative control of the franchise to Amazon MGM. But what was that? The video montage made sense, but why did it then segue into Margaret Qualley dancing on stage, followed by Blackpink's Lisa, Doja Cat, and Ray singing 3 Bond theme songs? Especially after the Oscars decided to cut musical performances of all the best original song nominees. Truly, the only question we're left with is this. Why? Another best, LAFD, that's LA Fire Department, tells jokes. At this point, we've seen just about every awards show this year honor the courageous members of the Los Angeles Fire Department, and rightfully so. The Oscars decided to take things to the next level. First, O'Brien brought members of the LAFD out on stage, at which point they received a standing ovation from the crowd. But then, O'Brien decided to involve the firefighters a bit more by having them read jokes from the teleprompter. Jokes that Conan wasn't brave enough to tell himself, like, "Our hearts go out to all of those who've lost their homes." And I'm talking about the producers of Joker 2. They seemed to have fun, and we were happy to see them do more than wave from their seats. One of the worst was the Hulu outage. Here's the thing about broadcasting the Oscars. You need to be prepared for a lot of people tuning in, and Hulu dropped the ball early on the show when some users found themselves unable to watch. According to DownDetector.com, the outage affected more than 30,000 people. Cut to the end of the show, and for some users, the live stream cut off during Sean Baker's Best Director acceptance speech, with two categories to go. Guess they didn't prepare for the show to run over? Get it together, Hulu. Number 7 is a best. June Squibb is always the best. This could also be filed under worst. No standing ovation for June Squibb. Because truly, why wasn't everyone in that room on their feet the second that the legendary June Squibb walked out onto that stage? Even when she's just there to present, Squibb leaves a mark, and this time it was with a silly little bit about how incredible makeup artists are. I'm actually being played by Bill Skarsgård right now, the 95-year-old actress told fellow presenter Scarlett Johansson. Half the time you see me in public, it's Bill Skarsgård. The real June Squibb is at home with a book right now. It was a small bit, but one that made the night just that much better. And our very best, it's a best, a legend plays tribute to a legend. The recent death of two-time Oscar winner Gene Hackman shook Hollywood, so it was only fitting that the ceremony found a way to pay tribute to the French Connection actor. To do so, they brought out Hackman's Unforgiven and Under Suspicion co-star Morgan Freeman to start off the In Memoriam. Gene always said, "I don't think about legacy. I just hope people remember me as someone who tried to do good work," Freeman said. "So I think I speak for all of us when I say, Gene, you'll be remembered for that and so much more. Rest in peace, my friend." That was the best and worst moments from the 2025 Oscars, and it was by Samantha Heifel. One other article that I have from the Oscars, and I would call it another worst category, Diane Warren reacts to losing 16th Oscar in a row at the 2025 Academy Awards. I'm consistent as F. This is by Jessica Wang. Diane Warren is taking her historic Oscars losing streak in stride. The venerated singer-songwriter was nominated for Best Original Song at the 97th Academy Awards on Sunday, but her 6888 tune, The Journey, lost to El Mal from Emilia Perez. It marked a record-tying 16th straight Oscars loss for Warren, putting her on par with sound mixer Greg P. Russell. Russell once had a 17th nomination, but it was rescinded due to campaign violations. "I'm consistent as F," Warren, 68, quipped to Variety at Vanity Fair's annual Oscars afterparty. "You know, it is what it is. I'm happy to be here. I'm the Terminator of the Oscars. I'll be back." That's in my Arnold Schwarzenegger voice. "I'm coming back. You can't get rid of me." Her work will continue as usual. "This isn't going to slow me down," Warren added. "I thought I had a chance this time. It didn't go that way, but I'm still here." Warren has won a Grammy, an Emmy, and 2 Golden Globes, and received an honorary Oscar from Cher at the Governor's Award in 2022. She has soundtracked such films as Burlesque, Pearl Harbor, and The Hunting Ground, among others. Warren's The Journey, featuring vocals by H.E.R., marked her 8th consecutive Oscar nomination since 2017. Warren told Entertainment Weekly last month that she believed her song was her most award-worthy yet. "This would definitely be the most deserving to me," Warren said. "There's been a couple back in the day, but honestly, it sounds really cliche, but it's not a cliche because it is an amazing honor to be nominated." They only choose 5 songs, and then you're chosen by your peers, who are the best of the best. You just hope that people listen to the song. If they listen to this one, it's a pretty good song. I'm really proud of it. Warren also said she didn't even know how I'd react should she win. I'd have to be conscious, she added. I'd probably faint. I'm not going to lie, it would be amazing, especially for this song. It's the journey. There's a lot of levels to the song that are really special, and that would make it more special if that happened. That was Diane Warren reacts to losing her 16th Oscar in a row at the 2025 Academy Awards, and it was by Jessica Wang. We have a TV review, Beyond the Gates, the soap opera America needs now more than ever. CBS's new daytime drama about a well-to-do Black family in Maryland is pure, glorious soap opera. This is by Kristen Baldwin. The last time a broadcast network debuted a new daytime drama, a good portion of America believed the president was a criminal, high-profile plane crashes were in the news, and Jay-Z was embroiled in a legal battle. That was more than a quarter century ago when NBC's Passions premiered in 1999. Call it serendipity or simply the cyclical nature of history, but conditions are once again ripe for a much-needed soapy escape as CBS prepares to unveil its new daytime drama, Beyond the Gates. Created by industry veteran Michel Valjean from Generations and General Hospital, the new series, which follows the lives and loves of a well-to-do Black family and their gated community neighbors, is soap opera in its purest and most enjoyable form. More importantly, this well-crafted saga of romance, backstabbing, and dark family secrets is a celebration of Black excellence at a time when the U.S. government wants us to believe that diversity is a dirty word. Best of My Love by legendary girl group The Emotions is playing on the soundtrack as Dr. Nicole Dupree Richardson, played by Daphne Duplay, cruises through the gates of Fairmont Crest, an exclusive neighborhood just outside of Washington, D.C. Nicole is the level-headed daughter of Anita Dupree, played by Tamara Tooney, an EGOT-winning singer, and retired senator and civil rights activist Vernon Dupree, played by Clifton Davis. The Duprees are pillars of the Fairmont Crest community, which makes the recent drama surrounding their family even more shocking. All of Fairmont is abuzz with the news that Bill Hamilton, played by Tim and Kyle Durrett, ex-husband of Nicole's sister Danny, played by Carla Moseley, is planning to marry his much younger girlfriend and former Dupree family friend, Haley Lawson, played by Marquita Goings, at the Fairmont Country Club. Not only is Danny spiraling over the news, she vows to make the cheaters pay for blowing up my life, but Bill's daughters, Naomi, played by Ariel Perpetit, and Chelsea, played by Ronnie Rose Mantilla, are barely speaking to him. After swiftly establishing it's juicy, this gated community ain't big enough for the both of us, central conflict, Beyond the Gates introduces the other characters in the Dupree's orbit, whose complicated backstories are designed to provide maximum story fodder. Nicole and her husband, renowned plastic surgeon Ted Richardson, played by Maurice Johnson, are surrogate parents to Ted's nephew, Andre Richardson, played by Sean Freeman, a handsome and flirty photographer whose parents died in a plane crash. Meanwhile, their daughter, Kat, played by Colby Muhammad, is helping her cousin Chelsea plot an exit strategy from her successful modeling career, unbeknownst to Chelsea's demanding momager, Danny. Nicole and Ted's son, Martin, played by Brandon Claiborne, an ambitious congressman, is haunted by nightmares he can never remember, much to the chagrin of his husband, Smitty, played by Mike Manning. As Fairmont Crest's preeminent realtor, Vanessa McBride, played by Lauren Buglioli, knows all the dirt on her affluent clientele, but even she may be harboring a secret from her heart surgeon husband, Doug, played by Jason Graham. The above description represents just a portion of the drama Valjean and her writers managed to set up in the first 5 episodes of Beyond the Gates. Trust that many of the other hallmarks of an engrossing soap are there, but in romances, dastardly revenge plots, and blissfully perfect couples who are just one dark secret away from being brought low. And of course, the first week builds up to another soap opera staple, a wedding, which in this case is less a happy occasion than a platform for a potentially outrageous showdown. A charismatic diva is the cornerstone of any successful soap, and Gates has theirs with Danny. Mosley, who played more grounded characters on Guiding Light and The Bold and the Beautiful, has a great time going bigger, bolder, and bitchier as the scorned and outspoken Dupree daughter. Right now, Danny gets all the best dialogue and Mosley clearly relishes how these zingers, "I don't wish you or your whore well," taste on her tongue. By contrast, Durrett is playing a bit too reserved as Danny's nemesis ex. Bill Hamilton is known to be charming and calculated, a criminal defense attorney who uses his power and influence to offer quid pro quo favors to those in his circle. Durrett would do well to ratchet up the sinister vibes just a notch or two. Subtlety has no place in soap opera. Tooney brings a regal composure to Anita, though I'm hoping writers will give the veteran actress more rein to explore Mama Dupree's fierce side. When the matriarch does get fired up, it's a thrill. "You need to remember who you are, a Dupree woman," she tells a despondent Danny. "We don't turn our power over to anyone." It's an apt sentiment for our current political climate, which goes largely unacknowledged in Beyond the Gates universe. The closest the show comes to referencing reality in the first 5 episodes is when Vernon reflects on his accomplishments as a civil rights activist. "Of course, a lot of that work is being undone," he muses, "but soap operas are meant to be an escape from real-world problems, and it makes even more sense here. In the real world, the residents of Fairmont Crest would be living a few minutes away from a White House intent on eradicating their ancestors' lived experience from history books. But the Duprees will not be erased, and their story is far too fun to ignore." Beyond the Gates airs Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time and 1 p.m. Pacific Time on CBS. That was Beyond the Gates. The soap opera America needs now more than ever. It was by Kristen Baldwin, and she's giving the show a grade of B+. And here's another review from television. Running Point, Kate Hudson's basketball comedy, is flagrantly unfunny. The Netflix comedy, inspired by Los Angeles Lakers owner Jeannie Buss, was co-created by Mindy Kaling. This is also by Kristen Baldwin. Moments after Isla Gordon, played by Kate Hudson, is named president of the Los Angeles Waves professional basketball team, her best friend and Waves chief of staff, Ali Lee, played by Brenda Song, offers a warning along with her congratulations. "You can never F up," she tells Isla. "When a guy gets a big job, he can F up a bunch, and it's them getting their sea legs or some S. But women have to be perfect right off the bat." That depressing fact gets reiterated many times without much variation or additional insight during Running Point's 10-episode season. The simplistic messaging wouldn't matter as much if the show compensated for it with a strong creative offense. But the new Netflix comedy, inspired by the story of Los Angeles Lakers president and owner Jeannie Buss, is puzzlingly listless. Created by Elaine Koh, Mindy Kaling, Ike Barinholtz, and David Stassen, Running Point wastes Hudson's star power and the significant comedic talents of its ensemble on uninspired writing and unlikable characters. All her life, Isla Gordon loved basketball, But she was a girl, and her father, Los Angeles Waves president Jack Gordon, was a sexist bastard. So he groomed her brothers and his successors instead. Eventually, Isla got a job with the Waves as head of charitable endeavors, while her brothers, Cam, played by Justin Theroux, Ness, played by Scott MacArthur, and Sandy, played by Drew Tarver, continued to run the team from the front office as president, general manager, and chief financial officer, respectively. And yes, they still refuse to listen to Isla's ideas, even though she knows more about basketball than the three of them combined. But when Cam steps down to deal with his crack addiction and names Isla his replacement, she finally gets a shot at proving she should have been the heir apparent all along. Of course, as the first female president of the Waves, she'll face intense and sexist scrutiny as she navigates the Waves' most pressing challenges. Taming problematic player Travis Bug, played by Chet Hanks, who's actively trying to get traded, helping Coach Brown, played by Jay Ellis, pull the team out of a slump and defying her critics, including Ness, Sandy, and a popular sports commentator, played by John Glazer, who are desperate to see her fail. Isla delivers much of this information in the pilot via a sunny voiceover, punctuated by freeze-frame introductions of characters featuring their name and job title scrawled on the screen in meticulously messy yellow text. The latter technique, which was novel when the Bernie Mac show did it in 2001, is another of Running Point's oddly stale choices. Every episode follows a standard pattern. Isla is confronted with a problem. A lost sponsor, trade rumors, a disruptive suspension, which she solves, only to be confronted with a new problem before credits roll. There's nothing wrong with that structure. It's the basis for almost all situation comedies. But it's on the writers to build something original on that foundation. Yet, Point's three showrunners, Stassen, Barinholtz, and Kaling, share the title, settle for the most predictable conclusions to most of the narrative setups, from episode-only arcs to the all-too-obvious finale cliffhanger. The lazy writing and general lack of originality is especially confounding given that Kaling is the mastermind of Never Have I Ever and The Sex Lives of College Girls, two recent streaming comedies that are as fresh and funny as Point is futile. What saves Running Point from total failure is its cast, not just the regular ensemble, but its deep bench of excellent guest stars, including Nicole Sullivan as Travis's meddling mama Bonnie, jury duty standout, and Ike's dad, Alan Barinholtz, as Bernie Berger, and the Gordon family's overly affectionate lawyer, and Diedrich Bader, as the Waves' long-overlooked assistant coach Tony. Though the Gordons themselves are extremely difficult to root for, Point's stars have enough charisma to make them watchable. Theroux brings a mix of brash magnetism and commanding frankness to his recurring appearances as Cam, while MacArthur leavens Ness's doofus man-child tendencies with an appealing earnestness. In early episodes, Sandy is drawn as brittle and almost mean, but Tarver's masterful deadpan and inherent vulnerability helps to humanize the aloof CFO. Despite their efforts, the only truly likable characters fall outside of the Gordon family. Charlie, played by Scott Evans, Sandy's dog groomer boyfriend. Lev, played by Max Greenfield, Isla's remarkably patient fiancé. And Jackie Moreno, played by Fabrizio Guido, a Waves concession stand clerk who gets promoted to be Isla's assistant. The more time we spent with Guido's Jackie, with his wide-eyed naivete and sincere desire to earn the Gordon's approval, the more I wished Running Point was told from his point of view. Hudson activates her considerable leading lady charm as Isla. This may technically be a workplace comedy, but the writers choose to paint Isla as a prototypical rom-com heroine, She's simultaneously a savvy girl boss and a clumsy fibbertigibbet. Sure, Isla is a basketball savant who can out-strategize her male colleagues when she calms down enough to get out of her own way, but she also keeps walking face first into the glass doors that lead to the Waves practice court. Maybe this running joke is the show's way of symbolizing the invisible but very real barriers professional women place in the workplace. Or maybe it's just a cheap sight gag to make Isla seem more accessible as a character. On Running Point, as in the real world, women are not allowed to have it all. Running Point aired Thursday, February 27th on Netflix. That was the Running Point review. Kate Hudson's basketball comedy is flagrantly unfunny. It was by Kristen Baldwin, and she's given the show a grade of C-. Even with my scratchy voice, I hope you would give today's show a better grade than that. You've been listening to Entertainment Weekly on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury. Thank you for listening this week. Please come back next time, and until then, goodbye.